this psalm, I believe, to be very appropriate to consider on the morning of God's holy day. Psalm of David, and he is contemplating the wonderful works of nature. We read, first of all, the first three or four verses. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language, but their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. Now from this point, as you read on the next few verses, David turns to the contemplation of God's great sacred law. That is the moral law of Ten Commandments, the great principles of righteousness, which are the very foundation of God's throne. And this, of course, is as it is because the works of nature are governed by the same perfect laws as is the government and kingdom of God itself. Today being the Sabbath day, our minds naturally turn to the, or should naturally turn to the contemplation of God's great and mighty works of creation, of which the Sabbath day is a symbol. And as we've studied previously, of course, and seen that wherever the mighty power of God is present, there in turn we find the seventh day Sabbath to be present. You can't separate these two things. And so David says, the heavens declare. And the word declare, of course, means to sound forth, to announce, to speak out. They declare the glory of God. Now, what is the glory of God? Remember that when Moses besought God to show him his glory, that God didn't come down and show to him a dazzling sun, an outshining of splendor, but God instead revealed to Moses the character of God and showed Moses just what that character was. And the true glory of God and the true glory of any individual or created being is not in radiance as such, not in outshining splendor, but in character. Because, after all, the character is the measure of the man. And as the Old Testament sanctuary so clearly revealed, the splendor and the beauty was all inward. The gold lined the inside, not the outside of the building. And like manner, the Apostle Peter says, let it not be the outward adorning of the individual, the plaiting of hair and so forth, but the inward adorning of the heart. But when David looked out upon the heavens and upon the earth, he did not see merely the manifestation of mighty power. And this is important. What David saw was the revelation of God's own character. He saw in the way in which God put things together the kind of God that God was. And until we come to the place where we can read the character of God in the book of nature, then we have not learned to read the book of nature. That must be very obvious and very, very apparent. We, of course, have our minds blinded by the prince of evil who has distorted the picture of God's character. As we shall see later in this week, Satan has masterfully taken the very best deeds of God and made them appear in a light of utter and complete selfishness. You know, for instance, to give a very brief thought on this, and I'll probably repeat this illustration later in the week, supposing that there came to you a man. And before this man came to you, he'd gone and found a very beautiful tract of land somewhere in the world where the climate was as desirable as this world can provide. And this tract of land was watered by a beautiful stream, crystal clear, that flowed down through it. The soil was fertile, and then this man at great expense had gone to work and fenced that land, built upon it beautiful buildings, a home, barns, sheds, and so forth, equipped it with the very best of machinery, stocked it with fine animals, planted spacious orchards and large crops, until that farm was in absolutely perfect condition and in the highest pitch of productivity and beauty. Everything neat, clean, well kept and perfectly ordered. And then that man was to come to you and say to you, now look, here are the title deeds to this place. It's all yours as a gift. How would you feel? You'd feel, wouldn't you, rather stunned, surprised, overwhelmed and amazed at such a tremendous gift. And you'd recognize the fact that you were completely unworthy of that gift, and you'd also recognize that this man was under no obligation at all to give that thing to you. he could have kept the whole thing for himself. And I read the story of a man who lives in England at the present time. And this man is one of the world's wealthiest men. His income is in the realm of hundreds of thousands of dollars per week. And he's got so much money he doesn't know how much he's got, nor how much he's worth, nor how much he's actually earning or receiving week by week. I shouldn't say earning, because no one can earn $300,000 or more dollars a week. And this man owns spacious estates, one in the south of England, one on an island out in the Mediterranean Sea, one in Italy, and one in other parts of the world. And in the fall in England, the fields become golden with the glory of the daffodils, and they spring up by the tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, on large meadows. I've seen them, and they're a sight to be seen. And this man, in his wide and spacious estates, of course, had literally hundreds of thousands of daffodils blossoming and giving their golden glory to the fields of his estate. And one day, a friend of his, or I should better say an acquaintance to the point where she knew him by his first name, and I'm going to call him John, because I forgot what his real name was. She called up and said, "John, we need about 250 daffodils for a special function for some disabled women and children. Real needy people," she said, "and we'd be glad to just have you allow us to come into your field and pick about 250 daffodils. He said, "No, you can't." "But John," she said, "you never miss them. You have tens of thousands of them there." His answer was, "I don't give," and put down the telephone. Now, the facts are he didn't have to give. They were his daffodils. They were all his, and he could keep them to himself, and he did keep them to himself. And that is the kind of person God could have been. God didn't have to give the Garden of Eden to Adam and Eve. There he'd come down, and in the most fertile spot on the face of this whole earth, he'd gone to work at tremendous expense and effort, and built a magnificent garden home for our first parents. Truly magnificent. They weren't even there when he did it, and yet God handed that thing over to Adam and Eve completely as their home, as their property, and as their possession. God didn't have to do it. And yet in the doing of it, we see the kind of character which God is. Coming across the north of Alabama a few days ago now, we ran through a very, very extensive and heavy rainstorm. And I looked around me as I drove along, and there were the homes of the heathen, there were the dens of iniquity, there were the farmers raising hogs and all that kind of thing. There were thousands of men and women who were debasing their bodies for selfish and immoral pleasure, and yet upon them this rain was falling. And I thought to myself, I wonder how much it would cost in effort and money and time for the human being to put that much water upon that much land in that much time. And obviously, you couldn't begin to compute the cost of irrigating so much land, hundreds of square miles of it, with so much water in so short a space of time, to say nothing of the nitrogen released, of course, by the lightning as it went by, and the coolness of the atmosphere generally is created by the overshadowing storm clouds. And I thought to myself, what a fantastic and unbelievable gift God is giving to these people today. He's making his rain to fall upon the just and upon the unjust. And God didn't have to do it. But just as David looked up and saw the heavens declaring the glory of God, so that day I looked up and saw, in the clearest possible way, the character of God as the great, great giver to even those who are undeserving of these gifts. And thus it is, if we look out day by day, we can see in the way in which God organizes nature, his character. And preeminently, the character of God is the great giver. Now, I've learned in my own experience that the man and the woman and the child who learns to participate in this characteristic of God and to give themselves heart and soul to his service, that they are the people who in turn reap the blessings that God reaps for himself in being the great giver to a perishing humanity. We find too, of course, that in the world of nature is revealed the character of God as the God of law and the God of order. Look at the fantastic systems that we see in nature. Now, a few months ago, the astronauts went to the moon for what was it, the third or fourth time. Of course, that last trip was a failure because of a breakdown in their systems. But think of the perfect reliability of the laws of nature upon which those men depended on their visit to that satellite of the Earth. They could compute to the exact point how much fuel they'd need, how long the fuel should burn at a certain rate to get them out of the Earth's pool, exactly what point of time to begin their journey, exactly what point of time to make their corrections in space, exactly what point of time to fire their retro rockets, and all this because the laws of God were so utterly and completely reliable. Now imagine what would happen if God was to change his laws from day to day. If today the force of gravity was just so much, tomorrow it was weaker, the next day stronger, the next day something else. Would such a flight have been possible? Absolutely impossible. Now, of course, men come back and praise men for what they have achieved. They praise the engineers, the scientists, the technicians, and so forth. They praise the men who went, but we don't hear men acknowledging what God did in the whole venture. They saw in that only the glory of man. And by the glory of man is not character. The glory of man is self-praise, self-adoration, self-esteem, and self-centeredness. And that's hardly glory at all. That's more in the realm of ugly darkness. What they should have seen was the glory of God as the character of God to accomplish something which men could never do. And we need upon this Sabbath day to come to the place where as we look out upon the great and wonderful world of nature, we shall read in that not just simply power, which is a very awe-inspiring thing to the human mind. But looking out there in the great realm of nature, we shall see what David saw. And what did David see? He saw the glory of God, which is the character of God. Let's read in the handiwork of nature the picture of God as the great giver of every good gift to the human family. And the more we see how it is that we don't deserve those gifts, that we don't deserve for one moment to receive anything of God because we haven't earned it. In the beginning we made no contribution to its existence. We're born into a world which already is here with all its systems and so forth. And so we don't deserve what we have. All of it is the gift of God who loves to give things to his children. Things which he could have kept for himself and enjoyed for himself. Because after all, the Garden of Eden was a garden that God could have kept to himself, could have enjoyed for himself, and could have made it all his own. But instead he gave it all away except for one tree to that first family down there upon this earth. And of course, if we're going to truly see the character of God in nature, then truly seeing the character of God is to participate in that character. That is to have the same character and to be the same beneficent giver of ourselves and of our time to those around about us. The sad thing about the human family is a thing which of course is trained into a child from his earliest days by modern wrong principles of parent education to their children is the idea that I am to be the great recipient of everything around me. That the world owes me my food and my clothing. The world owes me the pleasures that I seek. The world owes me luxury and freedom and leisure time and all the rest of it. We have to come to the place where we think no longer in any sense of what the world owes me or what people should give to me. Rather, we should think in terms of what I can give to those around about me, what I can do by way of contribution to the need of the hour. And when somebody gives me even the littlest thing, instead of thinking that I haven't been given what I ought to have been given, what's due to me, let's be thankful that I haven't been given that much. And in turn, dismiss from our minds what we think we might be owed, and in turn, give more than has been given us. Christ, of course, announced this principle when he said, if your enemy compels you to go with him 1 mile, what should you do? Cheerfully go 2. Or if he takes your coat, give him what? Your cloak also. And Christ was speaking figuratively, and the point he was making was this, do more than the world expects of you. If you do only what the world expects of you, then you're no better than the worst of the heathen. They do that and no more. Let's put our level best into all we do, not from the point of view of duty or of obligation, but let's do it because it's the character of God to be the great giver and to pour out blessings to all those around about us. That's why I said last night that if we're going to make this camp a success, each of you should come as a contributor to its success by bringing a spirit-filled life full of cheer and goodwill, a life in which you left behind your grudges, left behind your complaints, left behind those thoughts of what the world owes you and what the group may owe you, and think in terms only of what you can do to make the power of this message go more strongly. Then we shall have such a blessed time we had never thought it possible. We shall rise above the smallness and the meanness of the character of Satan to the grandness and the breadth and the glory of God. This is the Sabbath day. The sun shines down above us. The air flows around about us. There's water available to us and food upon our tables. We have life, we have health, we have strength. We have blessings, 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 so many that we could never begin to measure them. And in all this, we can look up and say with David, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. I just pray that the Lord will open our eyes, as David's were opened, to look out of and beyond and above our petty selves at the heavens and the earth, and to literally and actually see therein the declaration of the character of God. And then may it be that by beholding we shall become changed from glory unto glory. So until in the end when the Lord comes, he shall recognize us as his own, and we shall all find a path and a place in the glorious gift of a heaven and an earth made new.